Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm really excited to have this wonderful panel. It's taken us a little bit longer than I wanted just to gather the right group to have a discussion of the recent events in Mormonism that have surrounded the issue of race. It all began with an article in the Washington Post that was about Mitt Romney, but it sort of was the history of racism within the church. And we had wonderful Darius Gray and Don Harwell were going along doing their best to kind of give a great presentation. But one of the people that the reporter interviewed was a BYU professor who gave some fascinating, but just one's the groan, you know, the deep.
Highly offensive.
Yeah, there you go. Just those things that you just don't really love out there. You know, it prompted some response, and it prompted good discussion, and we're going to try to continue that and that good discussion that it's generated, reflect on it, reflect on how we're seeing the people around us process the events of these last 10 days or so since that happened, and just get our minds and brains around racism and institutional causes and personal racism and speculate and share what we think would be great next moves and just do the typical talking head stuff. So anyway, I'm so grateful to have our guests. They are all first timers to the podcast. Well, no, that is not true. Marguerite Dreesen, I'm going to start with you because you did come on, but it was on a show that I didn't host. It was Dustin Jones as the host, and we had Marguerite Dreesen on, and it was talking about the history and the current stuff about the priesthood ban. So it was more of a theological kind of approach than what we're doing today. But Marguerite Dreesen, welcome back to the podcast, and would you mind just giving everyone a little bit about your background?
Sure, happy to be here. Yes, you've got my name, Marguerite Dreesen. At this moment, I'm adjunct faculty in the communications department at BYU teaching media law and ethics. I taught law at BYU for 10 years. And then relevant to this discussion, you should know I'm an African-American female convert to the church, joined back in 1981, so after the revelation and at a time when things had not quite, the dust had not quite settled. And at this moment, I serve as a Relief Society president for the Genesis Group. Don Harwell, whom you mentioned, is the current president of the Genesis Group, and Darius Gray was the past president of the Genesis Group, so I'm very well acquainted with them. Also, my husband and I both serve as Genesis Group missionaries. So we're members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We serve as missionaries. We also are deeply connected with the Genesis Group that helps to serve the needs of African Americans within the church. So that's my perspective.
Fantastic. Thank you. Thank you for joining us. We're so grateful to have you. I am excited to introduce to our audience Gina Colvin, or have her introduce herself. But Gina and I have been, probably 6 months, we've been writing each other back and forth and sharing stories, and I've just really enjoyed interacting with you, and we're planning to do a podcast in about a month from now on Lamanite identity, especially related to Islanders, because Gina's coming to us from New Zealand. And tell us a little bit about your background and you know, your kind of your situation within the church and racially and all that stuff.
Hi, Dan, and hi, Mormon Matters listeners. Thank you so much for having me. It's odd actually speaking to you, not listening to you. As Dan said, I'm from New Zealand, from Christchurch, New Zealand, where I was born and bred. I am biracial. My father was a third generation member of the church, who impregnated my unmarried teen mother. And so I inherit his race and also his religion. And currently a university lecturer, and I think in the United States you call that a college professor, don't you? Is
yep,
that right?
Yep.
Yeah. Right, okay. A professor is something that we become when we're very old around here. So I'm a university lecturer and active member of the church. I'm currently the gospel doctrine teacher, and I have a blog called Kiwi Mormon.
Yes, you do, and it's a fantastic blog.
Thank you.
What do you teach, Gina?
Oh, I teach mostly cultural studies, critical theory, anti-racist pedagogies, indigenous studies, etc.
Wow. Thank you for all that you bring to this, and we're thrilled to have you.
Thank you.
Brad Kramer is that third voice that we've heard a couple of times here. Brad, would you introduce yourself to our listeners? We're glad to have you.
Happy to, and I appreciate the invite to participate here, Dan. I am a candidate, a PhD candidate at the University of Michigan in sociocultural anthropology. I live here with my wife and 5 kids. I teach courses on introductory courses to anthropology as well as biological anthropology and linguistic anthropology. I study religion and in particular Mormons. I also happen to be an active member of the church, and I am a regular contributor to the blog By Common Consent.
Yes, you are. And in fact, it's your recent post that I do you keep analytics? Do you know how many times your post has been opened or anything like that? Because it's made a huge impact. It's got a ton of comments, and you made some really great points that we're just grateful to have you be able to share with us tonight. But has it made a huge difference in your life? Or has your profile shot through the roof?
I don't follow the stats too closely, but it did. I did glance a couple days ago. It does seem like there was a bump that day. I'm not sure if it's attributable to that post only. There was a lot of different conversations about this issue sort of at the same time, and there was a lot of, you know, linking via Facebook and Twitter and stuff to the site. So it's a little difficult. And Peggy Fletcher Stack wrote her piece as well, in which she referenced the blog. So it's hard to know to attribute it to a single cause, but I would say that conversation around this question has definitely, like I said, given us a spike in our stats.
For sure. And I've seen it linked by everybody too. Just one more thing before we dive in. Well, actually, 2 more things. Joanna Brooks was going to be with us, and we just barely learned recently that she was just unable to. So we're sorry. We're going to miss her. We're grateful for her. She actually contributed some pre-ideas that I think we'll definitely incorporate into tonight's conversation. So I wanted to acknowledge her and thank her. And also I want to thank Rolf Straubhauer. I don't know if I'm saying his name right, but Rolf was one of those people right within the days of this story breaking that just said, Dan, you have to do this. And he's got wonderful theoretical perspectives, and he wrote, and I shared 3 or 4 of his sort of angles in pre-conversation documents with everybody here. So I'm really, really thankful for Rolf doing that. We're definitely going to have Rolf on a future podcast. All right, guys, let's just dive in, and I'm really excited. And this is an angle that I think we'll just start on first, because since this story is broken and since we've been watching the blogs and all of us have had a Sunday that we've been to church and we're in conversation with families and friends and things like that, I thought it would be good just to begin the podcast with what did Professor Bott say? What did the church's response say immediately after that? But mostly, what have the people around you been saying? How are you seeing them process this new conversation that is at least getting going again? So before I have you guys talk about the reactions or all around you or something like that, just to a brief summary is within the Washington Post article, Professor Bott started to talk about justifications for the priesthood ban. And these were his own speculations, but the nature of them was basically along a couple of lines that, you know, the Lord, it isn't racism because the Lord was in charge of this, and the Lord knew that black people were not ready at the time up prior to the revelation to receive it. And he used the analogy of it's like giving a child or a teenager a car and telling them to go drive before they're ready. Another time he says, you know, it was actual kindness to not do it because, you know, if you go up too high a ladder, when you fall down, you're more likely to be injured if you're higher up on the ladder. So he was just keeping them on rung one or rung two. And that way it was a loving God's actions to do this. And of course, this did not go over well. These make perfect sense to him and in his mind. And it's within that worldview of God is completely in charge. And no human being can really thwart God's plan. Therefore, when you're within that mindset, you have to come up with justifications. So after Dr. Bott did his musings and things like that, immediately, I think it was the next day, the church issued a statement that said simply, Professor Bott's comments in no way represent the views of the church. I won't read the statement here and things like that, but it was a very clear you hate to say a repudiation of the person, but at least a definite clear, that is not our view. Those things are justifications and things that we do not endorse. We don't know. And their rhetoric was basically along the lines of, we don't know why it started, we don't know why it ended exactly when it did, etc. So is that a fair summary, at least, of the background of the story, you guys? Did I miss out a key part?
No, that's
great. No, I think that's good.
That seems fair.
Okay, so with that as our background, and I know a lot of podcast listeners already will have that, let's turn to really, since that happened to you guys, what are you hearing? What are you watching? Gina, can I go to you first? Has this raised a stir at all over in New Zealand, or is it just mostly you're aware of it because of you're watching the blogs?
Yes, and it's a curious thing. I did a study on New Zealanders' understanding, or LDS New Zealanders' understanding of the, in inverted commas, the Negro doctrine. And largely, there was not necessarily a lack of engagement, but there was this thinking that really was an American problem, that issues of race that came out of, pre-1978 were an example of how religion and politics get conflated. And, you know, all of this sort of washes up in the tide and we're sort of left at the margins of the church wondering what it means to us. So in terms of an immediate reaction, I had none. I have the privilege of being the gospel doctrine teacher, and I think last week was on 2 Nephi chapter 26, where I think in the last verse of that chapter 26 is that, you know, all are alike unto God. And I was able to pull out the church's statement, and it was sort of met by like surprise and a pleasant surprise, and lots of people wanted to see copies of it. An older member of the church said, a member of the class said, I'd never heard anything like that. That's wonderful. So in terms of it actually kind of hitting the spotlight, no, it hasn't really.
Okay, excellent. That's neat to get that angle on it. And, you know, feel free to weigh in from what you have noticed on blogs or online conversations, though. Okay. But Brad, what have you seen? Have you noticed, you know, what are people saying to you? What are people saying in response to your post? But what are you all watching out there? Any patterns or anything?
Well, I'm seeing a few things. I mean, obviously there's all the reactions that you'd expect. You know, there's reactions where people are sort of trying to downplay it as a problem. There are reactions where people are getting really angry and indignant, and sort of where it's peeling the scab off of wounds that are trying to heal or whatever. You know, there's a lot of the whole range of responses that I think you'd expect in a church where you have a lot of, you know, different opinions and a lot of different ideas about some of the underlying questions at play here. But I have noticed a couple of interesting, I don't know, like patterns or just phenomena that I would like to bring to the table in this discussion. One is that I went out of my way to, in my post and in my description and subsequent comments and all the conversations I've been in, I've always gone out of my way to not just call it the priesthood ban, but to call it a priesthood and a temple ban. And when I only call it one of the two, I always call it a temple ban. And what I'm realizing, what I've been realizing is that that is a description. I mean, on the one hand, it's a just a, there's no way around the fact that it's a more accurate description. This was the worst part of the policy was not exclusion from ecclesiastical privilege. It was exclusion from exalting ordinances, from temple covenants and temple sealings for all black members of the church, not just black males.
And let me just tell you, it's really interesting that you're pulling this because as a convert to the church, I didn't even know about that aspect of that restriction until recently. Meaning I knew about the priesthood restriction, but didn't know that the church actually equated that priesthood restriction to all other temple blessings as well. It wasn't until I was participating with the Nobody Knows, the Untold Story of Black Mormons, that I found out it actually applied not just to men not getting the priesthood, but to women not being able to go to the temple as well. That is not something that is generally talked about or known, nothing that I heard generally just having joined the church after 1980.
And it's kind of funny because in its own weird way, this very embarrassing, very sort of unfortunate part of our history, I think actually teaches us something implicitly about the relationship between priesthood and the temple and the relationship between priesthood and women. That there is, that at its very deepest core, the priesthood, the fullness of the priesthood is inextricably tied to the temple. And therefore, you can't simply take the two from each other. And one of the things that I've noticed is that, you know, that description, the description of it as a priesthood and temple ban or simply as a temple ban or temple exclusion resonates really strongly with people who have always had a hard time, you know, younger generation folks in particular, people who never had to get used to the existence of the ban in the first place, people who have always been uncomfortable with it. But older generation folks like, you know, my dad or just, you know, people in his generation, people who I know that actually had to learn to live with this at some point in their lives, had to be reconciled to it, really take issue with my description of it as a temple ban. They think
interesting.
They sort of find it, they feel like I'm trying to describe it in deliberately offensive terms, or that I'm exaggerating its what it really was. And it's so interesting because I went and I looked back at something that I'd looked at several years ago, which was in around, I can't remember the issue, but there's an issue of Dialogue in the early 70s.
Where Mr. Bush.
No. I'm not talking about Mr. Bush. I'm talking about Hugh Nibley, and I would imagine it was a response to Bush. He writes this very short little piece in which he basically defends the ban. The way that he defends it is by treating as if it's only an exclusion from ecclesiastical privilege, and he does it by in very classic Nibley-esque fashion by skewering authority. But, you know, by saying that ecclesiastical privilege is nonsense anyway. And so
privilege schliblage.
Yeah. So he downplays it as a problem. He sort of bears this weird testimony that he, you know, that he believes it comes from God and that it's going to end, and completely elides the question of temple access.
Yeah, and I will tell you, I not only have read that article, I own a copy of it. I'm not going to go grab it now to avoid noise, but I will tell you, I read it a long time ago, and that's part of what contributed to me not even realizing that this priesthood ban was also a temple ban. It was a priesthood restriction. That's all it was ever described as. And oh, by the way, since I didn't join the church till 1981, it was all water under the bridge history to begin with. So it's not like anyone felt the need to dig in, and nor did I feel the need to go in and see if it was being accurately described. So it's an interesting concept.
So this particular phenomenon that I've encountered in responses, I think, is connected to another one, which is that I'm seeing that there are sort of – people are sort of two minds. And I'm sensing that for people who are more indignant about this part of our history and who want to more forcefully disavow or repudiate this part of our history in really strong language, that those people are seeing racism in any form as a very, very serious problem. And what I'm seeing from people that don't feel as strongly about disavowing the ban or you know, acknowledging that there was something wrong with the ban, and I know we'll talk about the details in this more later in the podcast, but what I'm seeing is a tendency to treat racism as a problem, but not a super, super bad problem. Like, let's, you know, a more sort of, let's put things in perspective, folks. It's bad, but it's not that bad. And this is something I actually encounter. Like, I grew up in Utah. You know, I'm white male, grew up in Utah. And one of the things that I did have come to realize in retrospect is that there's a lot of racism in Utah, but it's a racism of a peculiar flavor. It's not a sort of deeply entrenched white supremacy, you know, racism like you might encounter in sort of residual forms in the American South. It's a racism that manifests itself in part by trivializing racism as a problem. And so I encountered it most often in the form of a persistent willingness of my LDS friends, mainly my male LDS friends, to be totally comfortable making really offensive racist jokes really casually. So these would be the kinds of friends that were like, they would never use the F word in a joke because they were Mormon. And they probably wouldn't, like, they probably knew at some level that historical forms of racism and segregation and certainly slavery were really bad things. But using the N word in a joke, if there weren't any black folks around to hear it and be super, have their feelings hurt by it, using the N word as a punchline, not that big a deal. And so it got me thinking that if you, on the one hand, try to say, like, we don't like racism and racism is bad and we believe in equality and this and this and that, but we're not really going to say anything bad about the fact that we had this policy of excluding black folks from saving ordinances for most of our history. We're just going to sort of not comment on that. That actually reflects and reinforces a culture that says racism's bad, but it's not that bad.
Well, and let me interject. As somebody who currently lives in Utah County, I have definitely encountered the attitudes that Brad is talking about, but really it goes a different step, which is that there are a lot of people here who don't just trivialize racism, they clearly do not recognize it.
Good.
They act in these ways that are discriminatory, that clearly evince racial stereotypes or racial prejudices, and yet have a total inability to acknowledge that is racist. A dear friend of mine in an employment situation, you know, had the boss is absolutely treating her differentially based on race. And here's what they did. They said, oh, yeah, we're going to give you an executive parking place like all the other executives, but you can't have one up in the front because we're in this upscale area. And of course, if our neighbors saw that we'd given a black girl a position of this kind of authority, that would be terrible. So your parking place is going to be in the back by the dumpster. And they're thinking, we're not racist. Of course not. We're simply acknowledging the racism that exists in the community and trying to protect you.
Good.
You know, you're going to be hired to have this title, but we're not going to print you business cards because, heaven forbid, that out and people see that we have given a black girl a position of such authority, then there will be racist backlash against you. And these people do not understand that treating her differently because she was black is racial discrimination. And I scratch my head because this is not 1950. This was happening in 2006. You know, these are things that were happening recently from people who might I mean, they don't even recognize it. And I scratch my head thinking, don't they have a TV? Haven't they heard of the civil rights era? I mean, don't they understand that discrimination is treating people differently based on race? And there are people here in Utah County that I just really think don't. They think it's not racism or discrimination unless it comes from a position of race hatred.
Good, good.
That is so absolutely spot on. I mean, that's one of the these underlying factors that I've seen in the response, is that when I've been trying to make the case that the ban was racist, it turns out that people who are unwilling to see the ban as racist are people who think that racism is a solely mental phenomenon. That racism is only racial. It's only carrying mean-spirited attitudes towards black folks or towards minorities. And therefore, I say the ban is racist, and they say, how do you know? You don't even know where it came from.
Or why.
Yes. And I say, it doesn't matter where it came from. It doesn't matter if it came from people who thought that black people were superior.
Right. It's different.
It's racist.
Yes.
It discriminates on the basis of race. It excludes on the basis of race. It is functionally racist. Its consequences and effects are racist. It is racism, no matter what motivates it. And
right.
And the story that you described there, to me, it couldn't be, you couldn't script a better sort of microcosm of the problem, which is that in Mormon corridor in Mormon Utah, where you have this long history and this really horrible skeleton in the closet, to say racism is bad at the same time that you're not willing to acknowledge that a deeply and transparently racist practice was racist, you're going to breed a culture in which people who think that racism is wrong simply are incapable of recognizing the racist behaviors all around them.
Good, good. Hey, I want to tease that apart. So you mentioned it's not purely a mental state, and then there's this sense that because I don't have hatred or because I don't think they're inferior, I'm not racist. I how much is it like just the conflation in their minds of racism means bad people versus racism is embedded in systems of power and privilege and all the different, you know, you guys with your sociological backgrounds, and Gina, you're probably dying to throw in the right language here, but is it because it feels like, oh, I would be so bad to acknowledge that I'm part of a system of power that's racist? They're, you know, they're worried that that's going to reflect on them. Is there a way to tease those two things apart? And could we deal with it better if we could just say Brigham Young was not a bad person? This wasn't a reflection on his character. This was systems of power and, you know, the storytelling and all that stuff that he inherited. Get rid of the idea that he was a bad person because of those things coming out of his mouth. Does that make any sense?
Yes, absolutely. And I think sort of the one of the key ideas I think perhaps Mormonism fails to grasp is that white folk, particularly in the church, and there's a sort of a certain kind of Mormon disposition when it comes to matters of race. And I thoroughly agree with you, Brad. There's this sense that if I think nice thoughts, that will make me a nice person. Therefore, that I couldn't possibly be racist. But one of the issues is that white folk, they've got the luxury of choosing whether or not to know black or brown truth. They can engage with it or they don't have to engage with it. Whereas, you know, black and brown folk don't have that luxury, and they live consistently with the need to survive in a racialized communities and racialized societies. And so there's an inequity right there. There's an advantage to whiteness which doesn't get acknowledged. Of not having to deal directly with the exigencies and the problems and the kind of brutality of racism. You can kind of opt in or opt out.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, and I think that you know, going back to this question of thoughts versus larger systems and power structures and sociological patterns and things like that, you know, it's really easy it's super easy to treat racism as a problem that exists in the minds, in the hearts and minds of people, and only there, because then if you do that, you don't have to actually worry about changing how things actually operate.
Yes,
how things actually work. So you can say, I'm not going to let you park here because you're black, and that would cause problems. And it's not in my interest to let a black person have this parking spot. So because you're black, you don't get a park here. But I'm not a racist, and this isn't racism because I like you. I don't think there's anything wrong with black people myself. So it's not racism.
In other words, we don't have to
change anything that we do. And the most extreme version of this, you see this dichotomy breaking down when people saying, hey, we're repudiating all the folklore, we're repudiating the racist doctrines, we're repudiating the racist sentiments and ideas and mythologies and all these things, all the teachings we've repudiated. We don't need to repudiate the ban because we don't know where it came from. And the logical extension of all that is to say that if the ban were still in place and the 1978 revelation had only repudiated all the racist teachings, and therefore we had gotten rid of all the doctrinal folklore, but the ban was still in place, that we wouldn't have a racism problem in the church. Because even though we're excluding blacks, I know, but that's the equivalent of what that's the sort of logical correlate, you know, the logical outcome of thinking in these terms, is that you can imagine for yourself a church in which it's somehow the ban still exists, and that's somehow not racism.
Well,
of course it's racism.
Not that it's not racism because you don't acknowledge that it was. There's a difference between, you know, saying, oh, yeah, it was and I'm guilty, and just leaving it to be and do what it says. But I would also add to that, Brad, that there is a chicken and egg issue here, in that, sure, there was no big revelation pronouncing the ban and the reason. However, people made up reasons because there was a ban. If in 1978 all that had happened was that the church had specifically repudiated the three, say, most popular theories or all of the then known theories, if that had happened, they simply would have invented other ones. I mean, it's not that it would exist in a vacuum. They would have come up with other reasons why the black people were singled out for this treatment. They created them because there was a policy and they needed some way to explain the policy. And if you actually get into Mormon doctrine, get into the scriptures, get into the core beliefs of the church, everything they came up with to explain the ban is contradicted in the basic core doctrines. Just go with the article of faith, the articles of faith. Every reason they came up with is repudiated in the articles of faith. They were reaching, they were grasping at straws to explain the inexplicable in any other terms. And if we got rid of all of those, as you said, there would have been a happy day that day, 78, but then the very next day they would have come up with something else because the ban still existed.
I think one of the questions here, though, is who are we talking about when we say they? Because I think the big elephant in the room is the they happen to be, you know, a succession of presidents of the church. And so the elephant in the room is, yes, they could have come up with it, but, you know, they do so in the position as a president and a prophet. But how much of that is revelation? And, you know, we are to understand that kind of the equivocation around reasons for the priesthood ban to be coming from God, or, you know, how are we supposed to understand a relationship with kind of prophetic instruction and revelation and something that just feels theologically out of step?
Well, and it wasn't just the prophets of the church, however. There are certainly things that Brigham Young said, but a lot of his most racially derogatory, racially tinged comments were not spoken from a pulpit at General Conference, but were spoken by him as the governor of Utah or in some political meeting having to do with getting Utah's statehood, which was coming up around the same era of time when Brigham Young was the not just the chief of the CEO of the church, but the head of the government as well. He wore multiple hats and spoke in that context in multiple ways. And a lot of the other things, they arose after his time. The ideas were promulgated by people, religious professors, religious scholars. Bruce R. McConkie was never the prophet of the church, and yet a lot of the theorizing can be laid at his door. So it's not that I'm not, when I say they, I really do not mean just the prophets of the church. I mean people in the church who either came up with or accepted for themselves the truths of these various tracts of folklore to explain the policy that was then in place.
But there was still presence of the church who legitimated it. They gave it some kind of credibility.
Credibility so much as they didn't change it. They certainly didn't repudiate them, and they didn't change them, even if they never spoke these words themselves from the pulpit. They had power to repudiate them. They had the power to make the change and chose not to.
And there's something that we have to come to terms with, I think, which is kind of the underlying sentiment of my post, which is that once we commit ourselves to the proposition that racism is a sin, we have to come to terms with the fact that the worst sin in our history is not something Brigham Young said, and is not something that Joseph Fielding Smith said, or Bruce R. McConkie said, or Alvin Dyer said. The worst sin in our history, if racism is a sin, is the ban. The actual practice of excluding black folks from access to temple ordinances, covenants, and sealings.
Because then
everything
became,
else is extraneous to it.
Then it became systemic.
If not extraneous, ancillary to, you know, they're certainly floating around out there. But we have to go back to even defining racism, and that's where the problem is. You saw it in the Washington Post article. How did Randy Bott describe racial discrimination? Do you remember what he said? He said simply denying people something that is a benefit to them. He missed the point altogether. Discrimination based on race is not simply denying someone a benefit. It's treating people differently because of race, and he did not define it that way, which then prevents the question that Brad just framed from ever being asked, or the assertion inherent therein from ever being asserted or discussed, which is if we define racism in some really silly way, then of course we don't have any big thing to worry about. You know, well, what do you care? Denying somebody a benefit? People get denied benefits all the time. Yada, yada, yada. That, to me, was the part of the article that shocked me the most, because, quite frankly, I've heard all the theories. I've heard all the folklore. That's not the problem. The problem is, here is someone who says discrimination is simply denying someone something that would be a benefit to them. And that's not what discrimination is. It's differential treatment based on some characteristic. That is discrimination based on that characteristic.
And how often do folks who discriminate, do people who are participants in patterns of discrimination rationalize the discrimination on the grounds that somehow they are doing something nice for the people on behalf of the people that they're discriminating against? It doesn't matter if you think it's nice. It doesn't matter if you think you're blessing them in the process.
Right.
It is
you're
discrimination.
Good. And that's a way to kind of defang it, right? It depersonalizes it. It takes a lot of the emotion out of it, right? I at least see an opening there, Brad, if that could simply be communicated really well, that, you know, it doesn't make it easier to deal with.
Yeah. I mean, I'm much less hung up of, honestly, it's going to sound weird, but I'm much less hung up about the fact that past white male church leaders said things that today we can see as being seriously racist.
Right.
Like, obviously I wish that weren't the case, but like, I don't want to hold that over their head in the way that like I don't think that Brigham Young was more racist than Lincoln. I mean, maybe I don't know the histories well enough, but the problem isn't that these men held racist attitudes. The problem is what we did collectively as a church, what we permitted ourselves to do, and the terribly harmful, tragic effects that that had, the impact that that had on the lives of church members, potential converts, children of God everywhere.
Yeah, and that opens up to two different things, Brad. And one of them, it came out in Joanna Brooks' Ask Mormon Girl post that she did this week, where she was asking people to reflect on how this ban... And she was basically saying, have any of you really begun to process internally your life story and your interaction with this band and how it's affected you and how it's, you know, distorted, you know, various pieces of you, and you've experienced the world in a different way. And so what you've just raised there is that. Have you guys been seeing that kind of reflection? Have you? She posted to all of us in her little note saying that she couldn't be part of the podcast, this one fellow who really is, it seems like, wouldn't you say he's in his 60s or something, and he has been a church leader on this, but he was taking this as the opportunity to say, what did I miss? What did I blow? How did I hurt people unintentionally? And he was, you know, and he's got the perfect attitude of repentance about the whole thing. Are you guys seeing that?
I'm not seeing it, but I'll tell you, I'll just jump right in. I've been hanging out with Genesis folks who by and large are Black people, family, friends of Black people. And they are reflecting upon another leap forward in that the statement the church made, at least, has been their strongest one to date and the closest one to actual repudiation of the past folklore. You know, eliminating the ban was one thing. And now President Hinckley in the priesthood session a few years ago condemned racism, but he's speaking presently and speaking in terms of future conduct and how we should interact right now. This time, what the Genesis folks were rejoicing about is that the statement from the church clearly condemned racism, past and present, and specifically inside the church as well as out. So they didn't get specific, they didn't tie names to it, but they specifically condemned past racism inside the church, acknowledging thereby that there was racism inside the church, which is not something that had come officially from the church before. So the Genesis folks were celebrating that. And there were people who said, yes, this is a big step. Wish it had gone a little further. There was some of that. There were people, the Black people especially, weren't necessarily surprised about the comments that Professor Bott made. We hear them all the time. It was about, this is another step forward. And, you know, we're looking forward to the day when they make that next step.
Right.
But it's a baby step for one reason, which is that it would be so much better. You know, like they you got this anonymously written newsroom press release the same week that you got one of the most strongly worded and deeply apologetic first presidency letters I've seen in a long time in that same week. It was about baptizing Holocaust victims for the dead. It'd be great if that exact language, and I agree, it is novel language. It's just, it's very, I wish it came from a more authoritative source.
Oh, you mean the anonymous, the news release from the Church Public Affairs Office.
Exactly. I mean, Michael Otterson didn't even sign it.
Well, let's hope we're close to conference. This maybe was good timing in the scheme. Yeah. Hey, Gina, we haven't heard from you in a second, and there was like a while back, probably 10 minutes ago, you reacted really strongly to when Brad just says, "No, the biggest sin is not Brigham Young saying this. The biggest sin was the band," and it seemed like you got really energized there. So I didn't want to miss a chance for you to get some stuff in, or has the points that you wanted to make about that sort of come out yet?
Oh, I'm still energized. I'm just listening. It's interesting. Speaking to Americans is different kind of cultural ways of having conversations, and discussions. So, yeah, I've still got lots of energy. Yes, and I agree with you, Brad. The problem was the ban, and that's because it was a systemic problem. And I kind of posed in one of my blogs once if somebody gets it wrong, if a policy or something comes out from the church, it's usually God that takes the flak. And I think that's deeply, deeply problematic. Mm. Prophet God, well, we'll go with God because I guess he can't speak back to us. So it becomes a systemic problem. So all the kind of nasty dispositions in the world, you know, can be sort of circulated and reproduced generation upon generation. But when you've got a systemic problem, that kind of shifts it. That kind of challenges us to kind of reorganize our thinking. And we bring that kind of reorganized thinking, not to kind of personal sort of self-reflexive sort of, you know, thinking, to community. Like, okay, there is a systemic ban from a certain group of people from participating fully in the ordinances of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. What does that mean in a broader kind of, answering certain social questions? And it becomes much more ingrained. I think, Dan, you sort of hinted at this question of power. And I was kind of curious. When I first read that church statement regarding race in the church, I was quite heartened. But then it sort of caused me to question, who owns this conversation about racism in the church? And it seems to me that it largely comes out of a center. And we know what the center of the church looks like. It's largely white. It's largely American. It's largely, well, it is male. And it's kind of adhered to a particular model for churches, which is a deeply conservative one. And so with it, you know, when they say we don't believe this, the church doesn't believe this, we don't know how or why, my question is, have they moved that question out from the center to the periphery and asked people of color and black folk what their position is and how they would like to see the center change so that doesn't continue? And there's a big difference between moral outrage and practical ethics. And I think that's what we miss in the church. It's like, okay, now that we've got to the point where we can acknowledge racism, what does that actually mean in terms of pursuing a vision of social justice, pursuing kind of, acknowledging race and the different stories that people bring based on the kind of communities that they live in, which has been, or their experiences of oppression. So, I'm just sort of thoughtful about that notion of systemic violence that happens, which kind of moves our question of racism on from just do I feel it or not to what can I do to change it? What does my Christianity call upon me and my theology call upon me to make a change and make a difference? And would the church ever facilitate that? Would they be part of that conversation? Or is it just sort of, are they just exuding goodwill to all people and we just kind of stop there and bury our heads in the sand that there are actual, categorical violences that happen to, marginalized persons?
You asked the question of who owns the conversation, and the answer that you gave, I think, is partially correct, that if anybody owns it, it's, the center. At least the way that the church is structured now. The problem is that it's a conversation they're abdicating.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made on a blog somewhere, I can't remember, I've talked a lot about this in the last week. Maybe have even been a Facebook comment or something, but I sort of glibly said something that as I reflected more on it struck me as being actually quite true, which is that it's impossible to deal with a question really thoroughly and really in a really sort of clear and unambiguous and straightforward and brutally honest fashion while simultaneously pretending it doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
That is 100% true. But I would also add to what Gina was saying is that there are – it's not just the past violence that we're talking about. When you have institutionalized racism and you have what happened here, which is the theories that developed to support it, because it didn't come with an instruction book or an explanation. And so then you had the theories come to support it. Now you have the policy changed. You did not have the repudiation of the folklore in any way. And so what you had was the policy gone, but people in the church who still clung to their racist attitudes, discriminatory attitudes that resulted in the marginalization of people of color in noticeable ways, especially socially, where people wouldn't be welcome or just would be noticed, and there would be pressures, and there would be certainly a different status of life for a person of color in the church than otherwise. These are the artifacts, if you will, of institutionalized racism, even when they end the institution. So the conversation that they're not having, I've seen it. I've seen its corollary in the outside world. Instead of thinking of the church, think of, say, the United States, where, okay, once you have the court ruling that segregation isn't allowed, that's enough. Or let's just get rid of the idea of we won't have Jim Crow anymore. Now you get to compete on equal footing, except people aren't on equal footing, and they are not going to be on equal footing unless you somehow acknowledge the evil of the past and do something to correct the effects of that. And so the conversation that they're not having right now is, yeah, we've got this. We've now made this statement. This statement is that step in the right direction. It's the first time we've acknowledged past racism inside and outside of the church. They need to move forward, but I kind of look at this, it's sort of the church's, this racism question is, say, the LDS church's Achilles heel, the way that pedophile priests were the Catholic church's Achilles heel. It's something that when they finally had to acknowledge it, they didn't really know what to do. And so they shoved it under the rug, they moved people around, and that went on for decades until it finally blew up in their face in terms of the harms created by not addressing the problem directly. Now, we've got some of those issues. I mean, clearly it's not the same level, but I'm just talking about an analogy. We have our issue, and perhaps we could learn from the Catholic Church's example, and rather than sweep it under the rug, pretend that it didn't exist, pretend that it doesn't have these lasting artifacts that need to be dealt with, we should address them. But who's going to bring that up to them? As you said, at the center of the church, it is not us having that conversation.
Yeah, so I presume, Marguerite, that they didn't consult with the Genesis group about how to frame this question, how to address past racisms?
No, they did not. Although I will tell you, Darius Gray is not kidding when he said that when part of the reason the Genesis group exists is because devout, faithful members of the church who were descendants of, you know, folks with African blood were lobbying them. They were crying out to them, tell me what's wrong with me. You tell me what blot is on my soul or on my character. They were lobbying these people to reassess the situation, to reassess the question, and to raise it. And that had to have contributed to the fact that they did. They had vocal voices within the church, people who were people of strong character and of strong faith, people trying to be obedient in a situation where they were absolutely marginalized in direct ways, in lacking ecclesiastical authorities, and in the everlasting ways in being denied the temple blessings.
Well, perhaps the litmus test for when we, you know, there is some kind of change in the church is when that conversation about racism actually turns outward and people are consulted and not necessarily spoken to. And the need for kind of the marginalized to sort of speak loudly to the center is actually sort of eradicated because, you know, the center have actually turned, you know, faced outwards and said, tell me your truth. We need to hear it because we need to change.
What Darius Gray did, they didn't wait for the invitation, they just spoke. And what happened
neither
then,
Samuel the Lamanite.
You know, yes, Samuel the Lamanite didn't wait for an invitation, Darius Gray did not wait for an invitation, but they spoke. But the interesting thing was is that the church listened. And so we don't have to wait for the invitation. If you speak and they listen, then the seeds are planted. And it sometimes takes a while. It takes a while all the time, especially when the minds that have to be changed are the minds that grew up understanding what we now consider to be racist folklore as a de facto doctrine. They have to change an entire mindset that we didn't have to change.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.